Going to call the third case for today, 00-1100, Split Rock Hardwoods, Inc. versus Lumber Liquidators. Michael, is it Kreidler? Appearing for Lumber Liquidators. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. Again, my name is Michael Kreidler, and I'm here on behalf of Lumber Liquidators. And the relief that we seek from this court is as follows. I request an order of this court vacating the circuit court's order to strike the answer, and I further request that this court vacate the judgment, order for judgment in judgment entered at the circuit court level, and that this case be remanded to the circuit court for trial on the merits. The certification of this case made by the Court of Appeals indicates that the issue presented by this case is whether the circuit court has the discretion under the circumstances of this case to strike the answer. I believe that the issue as framed by the proper issue in this case is whether the trial court had the discretion to enter a default judgment under the circumstances. And I respectfully disagree with the circuit court on the following basis. By striking my client's answer, the court, in effect, was entering a default judgment, because at that point, the court, or my client, really had no basis upon which to defend against this claim. And so...
isn't that one of the issues that... how can you enter a default judgment when there has been an answer? I mean, you may have been struck, but there was an answer. A default judgment is when there is a non-responsive pleading. Isn't that right?
I'm sorry.
Default judgment is when there is a non-responsive pleading. There was a responsive pleading here.
Correct.
So one of the issues is there power to do that at all?
My position is that, you know, given the facts of this case, by striking the answer, the court, in effect, is entering default judgment. I will address that issue. I realize there's probably two different issues here, but it's our position that the circuit court did not have the discretion under the circumstances of this case to strike the answer and to order default judgment, because the default judgment rule confers upon the circuit court the discretion to order default judgment only if issues have not been joined. And so really it comes, you know, the issue is whether, what I'd like to discuss with the court is Wisconsin Statute 801.14, Subdivision 4, and that is the statute, of course, that deals with the filing of pleadings. Now, it's our position that under the authority set forth in the Snowberry case, that issue is joined at the time that a responsive pleading is served. And the whole idea of this joinder of issue is that issue is joined when one party has asserted a claim and the adverse party has served a responsive pleading which places matter at issue. And in fact, in the Snowberry case, there's some language in there that, if I may, the Snowberry case talks about at page 28 of the Northwest Reporter, that would be 126 Northwest 2nd at page 28, the specific quote is, issue was joined upon service of the original answer. There was no counterclaim, and either party could have served a notice of trial pursuant to the statute at that point.
But counsel, that case was before the adoption of Rule 801.14.4.
Correct, Your Honor. And the reason I cite that case was for the limited purpose of discussing when issue is joined in a matter. And for example, in this case, if there had been a counterclaim, I think in a normal pleadings, if there's a counterclaim asserted, issue is not joined until the counterclaim has been answered, because then the pleadings set forth those issues that must be litigated. For example, if And that's my position as far as when joinder is or when issue is joined. Now, in this particular case...
So under your theory, or under your argument, basically, you have an answer, you've answered, but you didn't file it, so a year later, I mean, this happens to be 40-some days, but 6 months later or 8 months, it's up to what... Then you control the lawsuit. You don't.
No, Your Honor, you don't, because all my position is this, that the issue was joined, and consequently, default judgment was not an appropriate sanction to be imposed by the court. It's entirely appropriate if the court concludes that there not has not been, you know, if the pleadings have not been filed within what the court construes to be or considers to be a reasonable time. Certainly, the court has it within its inherent powers to impose sanctions. And for example, Your Honor, in this case, I believe that an appropriate, you know, well, I'm not suggesting that this would be an appropriate sanction under the circumstances of this case, but if the court truly, if the court concludes that there has been unreasonable period of time by one party in filing pleadings, an appropriate sanction, for example, might be that party can't participate in the scheduling conference and may not have any say, for example, in the deadlines imposed by the court, or perhaps attorney's fees or other sanctions could be imposed. So it is not...
About an order to compel filing.
Correct.
About an order.
An order to compel filing.
And then if you don't comply with that, do you think the court can say as a sanction you're in default?
Well, perhaps under those circumstances it might be, because when a party has been given notice, if I might read to the court a section from Wisconsin practice on civil procedure, and this is volume 3A at page 14. Section 503.3 deals with or discusses failure of a party to comply with procedure statutes and court orders. It says, although Section 805.03 appears to allow dismissal for noncompliance with even the most trivial procedure statutes and orders, a dismissal with prejudice should be granted only in extreme circumstances. Dismissal has been used as a sanction for disobedience of a variety of orders. One federal court has identified five factors that are to be applied in considering whether a dismissal or default is appropriate as a sanction. One, the public's interest in expeditious resolution of litigation. Two, the court's need to manage its dockets. Three, the risk of prejudice to the party seeking sanctions. Four, the public policy favoring disposition of cases on their merits. And five, the availability of less drastic sanctions. And then it cites some other factors from another federal court case. But the critical language here is this, Your Honor. Due process requires at least a fair and adequate warning by court rule or notice of the imposition of the sanctions or penalties to be invoked for the failure to comply with a court order. Now, in this case, the rule that we're concerned with talks about filing a pleading within a reasonable time. And it doesn't really indicate, that rule doesn't specify what sanctions are to be imposed or could be imposed should the party fail to file pleadings within a reasonable time. And so if the party were then filed with or served with an order to file, as you indicated, Your Honor, that would then put the party on notice and give the party, I think that would satisfy due process requirements. But the statute...
You got notice that there was a motion to strike.
Correct.
And then you had an opportunity to come to court and debate that, which you did. You did it through the telephone, and the transcript was had. And you made your arguments, and the court said, disagreed with you. So didn't you have due process?
Well, Your Honor, we were notified at that point in time that the answer had not been filed, and we filed it promptly at that point in time. And so did the court have it within its inherent powers to impose some sanction upon my client? I'm not arguing that point. I think the court could have within its inherent powers, have imposed some sanctions. My position is that the sanctions that it imposed are just far too harsh. And the posture of the case at the time that this happened, the court had not yet conducted a scheduling conference. And I assume, and I'm assuming this, and perhaps this is an improper assumption on my part, I assume that opposing counsel contacted the court in late January in order to ask the court to schedule set up a scheduling conference.
Would it be ordinary for the court to schedule a conference before the answer was in?
My understanding of the rules is that the court has to schedule a conference within 150 days
of
the commencement of the action, the filing of the summons and complaint. And so the case was still within that 150-day time period at the time this all transpired. Under the circumstances, the court became aware of my involvement in the case, and I think the court could have, among other things, the court, I think, could have unilaterally, without notice to me, could have conducted a scheduling conference under those circumstances. I mean, that would be one appropriate, and that would be a sanction on me because I'd have no input into that. But I just believe that, given the circumstances of this case and the procedural posture at the time that this happened, that this, first of all, I don't think the court has, the circuit court had the discretion under the default judgment rule to enter the default judgment because issue had been joined, and it's just too harsh a sanction under the circumstances.
So it's an erroneous exercise of discretion to strike.
Well, I guess my argument, Your Honor, is the net effect of the court's conduct here, of what the court did was to enter default judgment, and I don't believe that the court had the discretion under the default judgment statute in the first instance to enter default judgment because it's my position that issue had been joined. Wisconsin statute 801.14 subdivision 4, it's my contention that that statute, when it was passed, it was not the intent of that statute to change the substantive law. And consequently, the Snowberry case, the authority set forth in Snowberry as to when issue is joined is still good law in this state. And the law in that case has never been overturned by this court.
Isn't there a problem with that argument? Once the judge grants the motion to strike, the answer has been stricken, the issue is no longer joined. Haven't you lost your argument once the judge grants the motion to strike?
Well, and if that is the way the issue is framed, then it's my position that the court erroneously exercises discretion. But I think because, you're correct, Your Honor, if it's framed in that fashion, but I think when you look at, the net effect of what the court did in this situation, it was entering default judgment.
Well, am I correct that the motion that was before Judge Gallagher to begin with was a motion to strike the answer?
It was a motion to strike and a motion for default judgment.
So first he struck the answer.
Correct.
And then because the issue was no longer joined, as far as he was concerned, he granted the motion for default judgment.
Correct.
We had a case last year in which, I think it was a termination of parental rights. And I didn't pull that case, and I doubt that you have looked it up, but it's possible, in which the decision was made that there was a default in the case, even though at one point in the case, it was the mother, did appear, and at all points in the case, the mother's lawyer was there. And but it was, and the lawyer didn't object when the judge declared it a default. That's as far as my memory goes. I can't remember if it became important in the case. But, the concept that there's a default when there really isn't what we think of as a default is not one that is unknown to this court. But what's reasonable? let's just take the proposition that we're going to not agree with you about Snowbury for the time being. What is a reasonable time after service? 40 days, 50 days, 100 days?
And that is a problem because it's such a subjective rule. All the federal court cases that have been cited to this court, the longest time period in question was 25 days. And, we're 20 days beyond that, 45 days. My position, if the issue is framed in that fashion, is that 45 days, under the circumstances of this case, are not unreasonable because that this all occurred prior to the issuance of a scheduling order. I don't believe that the administration of justice, the court's ability to administer this case, was affected at all by this delay. And so my position would be that under the circumstances of this case, that particular delay was not unreasonable. Certainly, Your Honor, there may well be circumstances where a 45-day delay is, could be construed as unreasonable, but I certainly don't believe that those circumstances, those facts and circumstances are present in this case.
Are the circumstances if there's prejudice to the court?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Would one of those circumstances be if you could show prejudice to the court?
I believe that's an appropriate factor to be considered because...
About prejudice to the plaintiff.
I mean, if in fact there is some showing that the court's ability to administer a case has been affected adversely by a party's conduct, then I think that should be considered.
Counsel, you wrote a letter to plaintiff's counsel saying thank you for your courtesy in giving us an extension of time to file the answer.
Correct.
Not serve.
Well,
file.
Let me just clarify. First of all, the person that wrote that letter was an attorney from Boston. And it happened to be somebody I went to college with many years ago. And he wrote that letter, and I presume he's not familiar with the procedure in the state. Not that that's an excuse. But if in fact...
Does he have license to practice in the state?
No. And what
does
he did...
that constitute practice in the state?
He was only asking for an extension so that he could retain counsel. But that, I'm not saying that that's an excuse, Your Honor. In other words, I'm not using that as a justification, but if, in fact, it was understood that they were talking, if, in fact, it was understood that filing was the determinative factor, the opposing counsel received that answer. It was served upon him on December 21st. If he, in fact, thought filing was the determinative factor, I suggest to the court that he would have moved to strike the answer and for default much earlier. He, in fact, took no action until either he was contacted by the clerk of circuit court or vice versa and was informed that no answer had actually been filed. So I think up to that point, he was satisfied that the terms of the extension had been met when this answer was served back in December.
Thank you. Those are answers to my questions. You may proceed with your argument if you have anything else you want to say or if someone else has questions. I think Justice Prosser looks as if he has a question. No, he doesn't have a question.
How does the issue of prejudice or the consideration of prejudice enter into this analysis?
Well, first of all, I don't... If you accept my initial argument that the court didn't have discretion to enter a default judgment or order a default judgment, then prejudice doesn't become an issue. If you get beyond that and you conclude that the court did have the discretion to strike the answer, then I think prejudice becomes very important because prejudice should be a factor. And I don't believe that there is, under the circumstances presented to this court, nor could there be, a showing of prejudice.
When you say prejudice should be a factor, what are you relying on?
Well, the factors that I cited previously, from the federal court cases, And again, I cite you to Section 503.3 of Wisconsin Practice, and it's found in Volume 3A of that publication. And the circuit courts that have discussed a similar issue under the federal rules, they always talk about prejudice. There has to be a showing of prejudice.
Are you primarily relying on that BioCore case? Or
well, this the two federal court cases cited in here, one is Wanderer, W-A-N-D-E-R-E-R versus Johnston, 910 Federal 2nd, 652, that's a Ninth Circuit case. And the other case is there's a series of cases cited at the other footnote. Well, the other one is Mutual Federal Savings and Loan Association versus Richards and Associates, and that's found at 872 Federal 2nd at page 88, and that's a Fourth Circuit decision, plus the cases that are cited in the briefs. And even by the court in its certification, the Court of Appeals in its certification, they talk about prejudice. The circuit court did not say in its certification that there must necessarily be a finding of prejudice, but it certainly raised that issue. And so I think just that in a situation such as this, when you're imposing such an extreme sanction, and you know, when we have a constitution really that requires trial on the merits, and we have a constitutional right to jury trial, that there should be a showing of prejudice. And I just don't believe that there's any indication of prejudice in this case, nor could there be under the circumstances. That's not to say that there may not be circumstances. Clearly there are circumstances where one party might be prejudiced, and that might, you know, tip the scales against the party, but it's just clearly not an issue, I don't believe, in this case. Just finally, it's our position on Wisconsin Statute 801.14 Subdivision 4 that change in that statute was not meant to change the substantive law, but really was meant more as a ministerial or administrative change in the rules. The purpose of that, as noted by the committee, was to eliminate the need for the filing of affidavits of service. It was not meant to change the substantive law. And in that regard, and in all due respect to the circuit court, we believe that the circuit court improperly interpreted the effect of that change in the rules. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Matt Onich. I'm from Ashland. I represent Split Rock Hardwoods. The facts in this case are not in dispute, and they aren't complicated. The facts in this case are somewhat different in two respects than quite a number of Wisconsin cases which deal with default judgments. Sections 801.14 and 801.15, I believe, are the statutes that govern in this case. 801.14 provides a two-step process for answering a complaint. Sub 1 requires service of the pleading on each party. Sub 4 requires filing of the pleadings within a reasonable time after service. Both steps are necessary in order for issue to be joined. So a party can be in default if they fail to serve an answer, if they fail to file an answer, or if they do neither. The Court of Appeals, if I read the certification right, says this is somewhat up in the air, but it goes on to certify cases or issues to this court relating on the issue of prejudice. I believe the facts in this case are somewhat different than the other default cases in two respects. In the other default cases, the party filed nothing with the court and served nothing. I don't believe that's a major determinant here, because you need to do two things in order to join issue, and doing one of them does not accomplish joining issue. The other respect that these other cases are different is, in each of them, the defaulting party or the party that did not comply with 801.14 filed a motion to enlarge time under 801.15. In that case, this was not done. In fact, they didn't even ask for that relief here today. And I believe that that's the distinction between our case and the other cases that have been considered previously. In Martin versus Griffin, that case makes it clear that when a late answer is filed, the trial court must first grant a motion to strike the answer as untimely before answering the default judgment. According to the Martin case, granting a motion to strike is simply a step in the process of granting a default judgment. Martin tells us that the propriety of the trial court's decision to strike an untimely answer depends on whether the failure to file the answer was a result of excusable neglect. As far as the issue of prejudice goes, you don't get into that under 801.14. You only get into prejudice under 801.15.2a, and that's where the defaulting party or the party who hasn't complied with 801.14 files a motion to enlarge the time under 801.15.2a. If that motion is made after the time specified, it shall not be granted, the statute provides, unless the court finds that it was the result of excusable neglect. And then under those circumstances, the Headkey case says that when the court considers to expand time or enlarge time, the court not only considers excusable neglect, but the court also determines whether it would be in the interest of justice, that is, whether the party seeking the relief acted in good faith, and whether the opposing party would be prejudiced by the delay.
Counsel, one of the things that bothers me is that the rules of procedure, civil procedure, should be clear and should be certain and shouldn't be an ambush for anyone. No, we're not here to trick anyone. We just want things to go through smoothly. And looking at what you just read under 801.15(2), and you talked about prejudice, and I had raised that question earlier, you said if the motion is made after the expiration of the specified time, it shall not be granted. How is the attorney in Bevent, or the attorney in Milwaukee, or the attorney in Plover, or the attorney in any other community in this state, know for certain if they can file a motion to enlarge time? Because the statute says under sub 2, if the motion is made after the expiration of the specified time. You refer back to sub 1. Okay, what's the specified time? Is it 6 days? Is it 14 days? Is it 21 days? You know, just give me an answer and I'll do it. Instead, we say, oh, it should be reasonable.
I'm sorry.
So I have difficulty with this because I think that it should be so simple. And yet, it seems like it's setting someone up for a problem.
Well, I think that 801.14 is very simple. In one word, says that you serve a party and then you file it within a reasonable time.
With regard to sub 2, if I want to make a motion to modify, that is, rather, a motion to enlarge the time, and I have not yet filed filed with the court within the reasonable time under sub 4. When is it still reasonable so that the court has the authority to grant my motion for expiration, or rather enlarged time? How am I supposed to know? If I would file a motion to expand the period of time under sub 2, and I filed that motion 7 days after I had served opposing counsel, is that motion made after the expiration of the specified time?
Well, you make the motion. In our case, for example, when I file a motion to strike and enter default judgment, commonly in all the other cases that I've read that's been reported here, the other party filed a motion to enlarge the time. And when you make that motion, then the trial court decides whether there's been excusable neglect or not. They consider prejudice and they consider good faith. In this case, Judge Gallagher never had to get to that point because we never had a motion to enlarge time. We had a motion for default judgment and a motion to strike. We showed Judge Gallagher it's a two-step process. He argued it's a one-step process. Judge Gallagher says, no, clearly, you have to serve and you have to file. We're entitled to have the answer struck. But the striking the answer is just part of the motion for default judgment. If the dilatory party files a motion to enlarge the time, then the judge decides these things. Is there prejudice here? Is there good faith? Does he have an excusable neglect, or why wasn't this thing filed within a reasonable time afterwards? I agree. If it said 5 days or 10 days or 15 days, it'd be a lot more clear. For some reason, the legislature or this court, whoever adopted the rule, decided to put a reasonable time under there.
And why do you think they did that?
I don't know.
This is a court.
Why do you think we did that?
That's right.
I'm not certain exactly why they did that, but I don't think that you need to get into, you know, the question was, when is it, when do you know whether you're after the time or not? Well, you make the motion to enlarge. If you think you're not after the time, you argue you're not under the, after the time. I mean, this is a discretionary call on the part of the circuit court.
Well, what I was getting at is they could have put within 20 days thereafter, within 30, within 5, whatever. But they used the word reasonable. That's what I was asking.
I don't fully understand why.
Did you file a complaint in this case and serve that complaint on the other side exactly the same time?
We filed the summons and complaint, and then you get authenticated copies and serve the other side. They were served in October.
Mr. Honest, you'll have to stand in front of the microphone so we're recording.
We filed the summons and complaint with the court as the procedure requires. You get authenticated copies, you serve the other side. That's another two-step process. If you file the papers, get authenticated copies, and don't serve the other side within 60 days, you haven't filed the case.
Well, it's the opposite than this. First there you file, then you serve. Here you serve, and then you file.
Exactly.
What I'm getting at is, would it be fair to say that you could file a complaint with the court and wait for 89 days afterwards, maybe even 90 days, without creating a problem before serving the other side?
No, pursuant to statute, you wouldn't have correctly filed the action. If the party is not served within 60 days, there's no jurisdiction.
But 45 days would be considered a reasonable time.
I believe they allow up to 60. It's jurisdictional.
45 days is a statutory time. It's okay.
The summons allows you now 45 days instead of 20. It's been greatly expanded, and in this case, Lumber had even more time than that. But what I'm saying here is that Judge Gallagher ruled correctly because there was never a motion to enlarge made, so he never got to the issue of prejudice or good faith or the matter of excusable neglect. In all these other cases, the person properly filed a motion to enlarge, and the court decides it. And based on what evidence there was here, Judge Gallagher made a correct decision.
In 801.093, it says, a notice that in case of failure to serve an answer or demand for a copy of the complaint within the time fixed by 2, judgment will be rendered against the defendant according to the demand. So there, it's the service of the answer. Is that right?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. I'm looking at 801.093. You give notice in that summons that failure to serve an answer within the time fixed by 2, which is 45 days now, you're going to get the default judgment is going to be rendered. It doesn't say that failure to serve an answer and failure to file it within a reasonable time, judgment will be rendered against you.
Yeah, not every provision that in civil procedures set forth in a summons alone, but I think 801.14.4 is pretty clear.
I'm a little confused. 801.02.1, civil action in which a personal judgment is sought is commenced as to any defendant when a summons and complaint naming the person as defendant are filed with the court, provided service of an authenticated copy of the summons and of the complaint is made upon the defendant under this chapter within 90 days after filing. Well, I read this
before the lectern, please. Just take the book.
I take this, and correct me if I'm wrong, is giving you some giving a plaintiff some discretion of not filing with the defendant immediately, even though it's been filed with the court.
It does allow 90 days to serve. A lot of times you have a hard time finding people. They may be across the country. And, of course, if a party never gets served, I'm sure that's fine with them. They probably never wanted to get served. That's the jurisdictional time that you have to file a party once the action's been started, or serve a party once the action's been started. But the point I was making in this case, when you look at what Judge Gallagher did, he had a motion to strike and a motion for default judgment. He had to determine whether 801.14.1 and 2 applied or required both service and filing. He determined that that was the case. He determined that 45 days was not a reasonable time to take to accomplish that. And he had no motion to enlarge time under 801.15.2 in front of him, so he didn't have to get into the matter of prejudice. He didn't have to get into the matter of excusable neglect or good faith, and otherwise he would. There's a well-developed body of case law in Wisconsin around these statutes, including the Martin and Hedke cases, and I don't think there's any reason to create another prejudice requirement beyond what already exists. There are public policy reasons, I believe, that a court should be allowed to exercise its discretion in this regard, as courts have been doing for decades in this state. Inquiry was made as to what occurred here. What happened here was at the end of January, the judge's assistant called me up and said they wanted to know why I was neglecting this case. I told her I wasn't neglecting the case. She said there's nothing in the court file at all, and the guy was served back in October. I said I'd follow up on it, and when I did check with the clerk of court, they confirmed there was nothing of record at all. There's argument made about the judge sending out a scheduling order or a notice of a scheduling conference. How can the judge do that? He doesn't know if it's contested. There's no answer. He doesn't know who the other lawyers are. Does this court want to establish a rule that every circuit court has to have enough staff to call up plaintiff's counsel in every case and say, is this case contested? Are there lawyers on the other side? What are their names and addresses? I don't think so. As far as the prejudice to the court requirement, this is a legitimate thing that I believe should be considered by a court in ruling on a motion to enlarge time, just as the court considers prejudice any time there's a motion to enlarge time. I think if you establish a policy where the innocent party has to start carrying burdens of proving prejudice, it's not reasonable. Right now, we've got Section 801.15.2 that clearly puts the burden on the dilatory party to make the motion and to present the evidence, and that's the way that it should be. If you establish a situation where it's impossible for an innocent party to obtain a default judgment, you're going to have situations where counsel will strategically not file their answer with the court just to slow down the progress of a lawsuit. As far as the due process argument goes, I suggest that every attorney in this state knows that when his client comes in with a summons and complaint, the first question he gets, when did he get served? What's the deadline? We don't want anybody to be in default here. Do I need to ask for an extension of time from the other side, like occurred here, and which we reasonably granted?
What if,
I believe that there are
counsel,
no pressure.
If I could interrupt for a moment, what if the answer had been filed timely but not served timely?
They still would not have complied with Section 801.14, and I don't believe issue would have been joined until both steps had been taken.
But under that scenario, the excusable neglect, prejudice, etc. standards of Hedke would probably apply to any motion, right?
I believe you're correct, yes.
So what you're proposing really is the evaluation of motions for default judgment accompanied by a motion to strike a timely served answer, which was not timely filed, a stricter standard for the failure to timely file than that which applies to the failure to timely serve, which seems to me to be inequitable and not to make a whole lot of sense.
I don't think that's the case. I think that if they had not served, they still haven't complied and joined issue under 801.14.
Right, I agree. And then we typically give the party and counsel a chance to demonstrate excusable neglect and show lack of prejudice under Hedke, etc. So the way that courts deal with a failure to timely serve is to make that opportunity available. And we even go so far as to say that if the party has the basis to reopen a judgment under 806.07 for excusable neglect or any of the other enumerated factors, they can have the court address that preemptively on the default judgment motion, right? Under the Shirk case. So typically we give people opportunities to explain and show lack of prejudice and excusable neglect as a part of the policy to give litigants their day in court. And what you're proposing and what the trial court did in this case is say, in this category of failure to comply with the statutory deadline, we should not make any of those opportunities available.
No, I don't think so. I think if they either fail to file or they fail to serve within the time, they haven't complied with 801.14, so that a motion to strike and for default judgment is appropriate to be filed. But the opposing counsel can file a motion to enlarge time, and at that point the court will then consider all the factors such as prejudice, excusable neglect, and good faith.
Okay, so your argument is that because they failed to file the motion to enlarge time with the answer attached, that
right.
It should be handled differently.
Yes, I don't think a circuit judge has to rule on motions that are never filed. The Court of Appeals asked Judge
What's
Gallagher...
What's the motion? The motion is to enlarge the time for filing?
Yes, that's correct. And if that motion was filed, then Judge Gallagher has to look for prejudice, and he has to see, is it in good faith? Why didn't they do it? Now, I don't know if it was strategic here to argue 45 days, we won't file a motion to enlarge, or is it more a matter they didn't feel they had excusable neglect and wouldn't be able to meet a standard? You know, it's speculation on my part, but the judge, this is what was in front of him, and he made the right decision.
But counsel, we're dealing with the time to file is reasonable. That means reasonable people can differ as to what's reasonable. And so instead of their filing a motion to enlarge the time for filing, you filed a motion to strike, and they objected to it. So you can say that's what they're doing then. They're saying, I got it. And in fact, they filed it by the time you got to court, didn't they?
They did, but I think 801.15.2 is pretty specific in saying it shall not be granted unless the court finds the failure to act was the result of excusable neglect and no excusable neglect.
It says when an act is required to be done at or within a specified time. Does specified time mean reasonable time? Specified time to me means 20 days, 30 days, whatever it says, 90 days. Specified time is reasonable. That's not really a time you can put your arms around because we don't know if it's 20 days or 21 days. So I'm not so sure two is covering here, but I think the issue might very well be, if I phrase it a little differently, is under these circumstances, and this is, I think, what Justice Sykes was saying, no ifs and buts, no excusable neglect, no determination whether you have a valid defense, no justification for reopening if there was a default judgment. You're out of here, period. So why is you're out of here, period, fair when under all these other circumstances you look at a whole variety of defenses? That's the point of the question. I mean, put it in terms of a variety of details in the statute, but that's essentially it. And to put it even more broadly, the law doesn't favor default judgments. The law attempts to give people their day in court.
Right, but you're entitled to all this if you file a motion to enlarge time, which was never filed here. I mean, you can't expect a judge to rule on a motion that isn't filed.
Well, how could they file a motion to enlarge time in advance of a court's decision about whether the answer was filed within a reasonable time?
Well, I think if you look at every one of the reported cases, though, whether it's Hetke or Martin or any of these, the motion for default judgment and the motion to strike is met by a motion to enlarge time. It's a standard procedure. If you miss the deadline, you ask the judge to enlarge it, and he hears all the facts. It's a discretionary determination.
Such a motion concedes untimeliness, doesn't it?
Well, you file it as a case that that's the way it goes.
What other filing deadline exists in the statutes that isn't a numerical period of time, but is a reasonable period of time? Are you familiar with any?
I don't know if I've done a search for them.
Yeah, to the best of your knowledge, I don't know either, but nothing comes to mind. It just seems like such a amorphous thing to do in a rule of civil procedure.
Well, some of the statute of limitations, when you think about them, you know, from discovery or from different events like that that aren't very clear, they begin to run.
In our rules of civil procedure.
80607, motion to reopen a judgment.
Oh, yeah.
That's within a reasonable time.
Mm-hmm. Or no event later than...
There's one. Do you look up cases under 80607 as to what constitutes reasonable?
It constitutes what?
Reasonable, what a reasonable time for a filing of a motion to reopen a judgment under 80607.
I guess I didn't think that 45 days was anywhere near reasonable. If you're going to say that my client who didn't get paid has to wait 45 days now, it used to be 20 days. Now they get a month and a half before they even have to respond to the complaint. And then do they get another month and a half before they even file their pleadings to the court? We're going 90 days already. I mean, somebody gets cheated out of money they're entitled to. What kind of relief does the law provide them? If we're going to delay things out so long before a judge can even think about scheduling a scheduling conference, you know? I mean, you can impose another level of prejudice on every single deadline throughout the civil procedure code.
Could you have filed this answer?
I'm sorry?
Could you have filed the answer?
Could I have filed the answer?
Yeah, I mean, you got a copy, you got an answer from them that was served on you. You could have gone to the courthouse and filed it.
No, I can't file the original answer. They've got it.
Can you file a copy and say, here's an affidavit that this is what was filed on me, and that I want because I want this to proceed, and that you should can start with the scheduling and have them know that, or you could have called them or written them and said, file. We're in a hurry. You owe us $32,000. Let's move it.
Yeah, we'd have no interest in doing that. I'd prefer to get a default judgment and get the money we're entitled to.
Why? Okay, so I mean, your client's not going to...
I get attorneys on the other side missing all kinds of deadline dates. It's not my job to handle their case for them. I think any of you that have been judges know all about how those things work. But But I'm just saying, when you look at what Judge Gallagher did here, he came to this hearing very well prepared. He'd researched the law. He questioned both of us about when his issue joined in terms of one-step or two-step. He exercised his discretion properly, and he never had the motion to enlarge in front of him. So you can't expect him to rule on a motion that was never made.
What discretion will the judge have if we say that this should be 45 days? I mean, is it then a game where you look at each case individually, and sometimes it would be appropriate 45, and sometimes it would be appropriate 50, and sometimes appropriate at 10 days?
Well, I agree it would be a lot easier if there was a specified number. People would know where they stood easier. I'm sure that that's one of the factors the court can take into account on a motion to enlarge. And thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Donish. Mr. Kreidner, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
I have a question right away. Why didn't you file a motion to enlarge time?
Well, because that thought, quite frankly, never entered my mind, because I didn't think that the 45 days was unreasonable.
And you didn't think you were untimely?
I didn't think so, not under the circumstances that were present at the time. Because, you know, I think the really significant factor from my perspective, and I have been practicing in Wisconsin for a number of years, and I have an appreciation of the way civil litigation proceeds, and I have an appreciation of the significance of a scheduling conference and the court scheduling order. And I know, I mean, I've been involved in cases where parties didn't comply with the scheduling order, for example, and I know what dire consequences can result from that, from not disclosing expert witnesses and such. And so this was a case where there had not been a scheduling conference. There had been no scheduling order. And so under the circumstances, the delay of 45 days in filing it, I didn't think that that was an unreasonable delay under the circumstances.
Why wouldn't you? Well, I don't know. Maybe.
Why didn't I file the answer?
I haven't practiced for a while, but since 79, but it was always relatively automatic. When you file an answer, you file. When you answered something, you file it with the court.
Your Honor.
That way the trial judge would know that there has been a joinder of issue.
Your Honor, that's a very legitimate observation. I believe my admission date in this state was in 1987. It has always been my practice to serve and file an answer contemporaneously. In this particular case, it happened over the holiday season. I was preparing for a trial in Duluth, and this is mentioned in my affidavit. I delegated that responsibility to somebody else. I didn't argue that because I'm the one that's ultimately responsible. When I got the default judgment, needless to say, I had a very empty feeling in my stomach, and I went to the person to whom I had delegated this, and that person, I said, "Did you file it?" "No, they had not." And that person, it's my fault, because I should have explained it to him, but he is admitted only in Minnesota. And in Minnesota, you don't have to file. Now, those are the circumstances. It's my fault, because I'm the attorney that's admitted to practice in Wisconsin, and I should have supervised it a little bit more closely, but that's what's happened. I've never done that before, and it is my practice, and it is the usual practice to serve and file contemporaneously or certainly in less than 45 days. But I think under the circumstances of this case, I don't think it makes any difference. And I believe with that, I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kreidler. And thank you, Mr. Onish. And we appreciate your both having come here at a long distance when difficulties in the country make our attention span limited to matters and in terms of traveling. So we do appreciate that. Thank you for good arguments, both of you. And safe travels home. We had a slight buzzing at one point. Okay. fine. Thank you. It sure do. Whether I intend it or not.